From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as world leaders gathered in Israel for the funeral of Ariel Sharon, we talk about the controversial mark he left on the history of the Middle East.
Prime Minister Sharon was not only loved by the Jewish people, he not only loved them, but he loved the land of Israel. Not just the idea of it, but the actual land itself.
The taps in West Virginia are turning once again. Our correspondent in the state capital has the latest on the chemical contamination. Also today, the alleged scandalous affairs of the French president are made public.
If the First Lady is not any longer first in the heart of the French president, why is she occupying a wing of the Élysée Palace?
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has been laid to rest in a military burial in Israel. His funeral followed an official memorial ceremony for the controversial politician, who died last week after several years in a coma. A number of high-profile international leaders attended the state commemoration, which took place outside Israel's parliament, the Knesset. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Israeli President Shimon Peres delivered the eulogy to Ariel Sharon at the ceremony, attended by Vice President Joe Biden and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other international leaders. In his speech, the U.S. Vice President praised Ariel Sharon for his tenacity, but also acknowledged he was a complex man, to whom reactions were profoundly mixed. The ceremony attracted thousands of mourners from all political persuasions.
The United States and Russia are discussing the possibility of establishing localized ceasefires in Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov are meeting in Paris ahead of peace talks in Geneva next week. Kate Fisher has more.
Both Mr. Kerry and Mr. Lavrov said they hope that ceasefires could be in place before the talks, along with plans for prisoner exchanges and the opening of humanitarian corridors. But the Secretary of State sought to manage expectations for early success in the negotiations between the Syrian regime and opposition forces. On the subject of Iran's participation in the peace talks, Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Brahimi said Iran should take part, but Mr. Kerry said it must first of all endorse the goal of the negotiations, that is, the establishment of a transitional government to rule Syria.
Former U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has candidly expanded on the controversial criticism of President Obama and Vice President Biden found in his new memoir, Duty. In an interview with NPR, Gates lambasted the president's staff, saying they interns were inept in job performance and gave the president poor counsel, stoking discord between President Obama and military leaders. However, the former defense secretary also said he took pains in his book to describe the president in a nuanced and fair manner, saying that President Obama was personally kind and always made decisions he felt to be in the country's best interest. In his interview, Gates said that some of his most controversial quotes are being taken out of context by those looking to use them for their own political ends.
Some people who have a narrative on Obama and the war got out there early with their take on what I've written, and I think shaped their discussion of the book to support their narrative of what had taken place.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. India is now officially polio-free, as it's been 3 full years since the last reported case of the disease. The news comes after years of a massive public health campaign. India's Minister of Health called it a monumental milestone. Residents in the U.S. state of West Virginia have been told a 5-day ban on tap water following a chemical spill will soon be lifted. A leak into the Charleston River has meant that as many as 300,000 people in West Virginia have been without running water for washing and cooking. It's unclear how and why the leak occurred. Priscilla Huff is in West Virginia with the latest.
West Virginia's governor says there is a light at the end of the tunnel for this water crisis in Charleston, West Virginia. The Elk River has been consistently testing for the past 24 hours for significantly lower levels of the toxic chemical, which shut off the public water supply to 300,000 residents in 9 counties. With these lower levels of this toxic chemical that was spilled from Freedom Industries, That means they can begin to test the public water supply and begin to flush out the entire system. The top priority, local officials say, for the region are the hospitals, and then they're going to try to allow people back.
And according to a new report, initial estimates that half of the United Kingdom's population will be obese by 2050 have underestimated the scale of the problem, and that Britain is in danger of surpassing that projection. Natalie Powell reports from London.
The obesity lobby group says it wants to see health officials tackle the problem by introducing hard-hitting awareness campaigns, much in the same way that they've done for smoking in the UK. Original estimates made by the Foresight report in 2007, predicting that 50% of the UK will be obese by 2050, are now thought to underestimate the problem. Campaigners say that 7 years on from those estimates, and the situation in the UK is not improving.
And that's the latest feature story. News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A ban on tap water has begun to be lifted in West Virginia after a chemical spill entered the water system, contaminating the supply to hundreds of thousands of residents in and around the Charleston area. The region's entire plumbing system will need to be flushed after 7,500 gallons of toxins leaked into the Elk River, triggering a widespread health warning. Earlier, I spoke to FSN's Lorna Shaddick in the West Virginian state capital, Charleston.
Following a press conference held by the governor of West Virginia, Earl Ray Tomblin, a few hours ago this Monday. The ban on the use of water is now slowly being lifted, but not everywhere and not all at once is the main message. So they began lifting the ban this Monday morning in hospitals in Charleston, the state capital. Work on that began Monday morning. And the way that when this ban is lifted, what they're asking customers to do and what these hospitals are doing was flushing the water through the system. So the idea is that you leave your hot taps on for 20 minutes, then your cold tap on for 5 minutes, then any outside taps on for another 5 minutes to ensure that any of the affected water has passed through the system. So you can imagine that takes quite a lot of time and effort to do. Hospitals have begun work on that in downtown Charleston, and then the areas affected, which spreads over 9 counties, are being split into different zones, and each of those zones in turn will be notified when it's their turn to start flushing their taps and getting the water back on stream again. But the authorities were keen to stress that the levels of the chemical that was released into the water, which was 4-methylcyclohexane methanol, or being called here MCHM, are now below the maximum level that it was. So in 90% of the areas tested, the water is now safe.
And you talk about contamination levels dropping. When they were at their highest point, were there health implications?
The authorities have said, I spoke to one doctor who's in charge of Charleston County earlier, and he said that overall, to the various different health departments and the West Virginia Poison Center, there have been, he thought, around 11,000 phone calls with people concerned. Because, of course, when this came to light on Thursday, there was a gap between when the authorities realized that there had been a leak and when that was made public. So people weren't necessarily sure whether they'd been drinking the infected water or using it to wash with. So many people were very concerned about that. There have been 31 people who presented symptoms at hospitals across 10 different hospitals in the area. 14 of those people have been admitted to hospital. And the symptoms apparently being presented seem relatively mild. It's things like nausea, some difficulty breathing, rash on the skin of the throat, the chest and the stomach. But really, the problem with this is that there seems to be a lot of unknowns. And the doctor that I spoke to admitted this because there haven't been any tests done with this chemical on humans, only on rodents. So nobody really knows the long-term effects or even the short-term effects of this chemical. And for that reason, sort of lack of knowledge means that there's a great deal of anxiety here. There's also some concern that the fact that people aren't washing their hands, because, of course, there isn't any clean water for them to do so, could potentially lead to the spread of flu and other illnesses in the future.
Inevitably, a case like this will trigger investigations, recommendations and an inquiry at some point.
Well, the authorities here aren't talking about that just yet. They seem perhaps rightly at the moment focused simply on getting the water back on. But it certainly does seem that serious questions need to be asked, particularly because I've discovered that a team of federal experts 3 years ago urged the state of West Virginia to create a new program to prevent hazardous chemical accidents of exactly this kind. Back in 2011, they sent a report to the U.S. Chemical Safety Hazard Investigation Board saying that changes needed to be made. Recommendations were made which could potentially have prevented this from taking place, but nothing was done. So serious questions need to be asked about why that was, and perhaps that those recommendations now need to be implemented post-haste.
FSN's Lorna Shaddock in Charleston, West Virginia. This is FSN Reports.
One Israeli prime minister told me over 35 years ago, "Senator, don't worry. We Jews have a secret weapon in our struggle in the region. We have nowhere else to go." That realization is what energized your entire generation of leadership.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, alongside Israeli and international leaders, speaking at the funeral of former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. He died after 8 years in a coma following a stroke in 2006. Ariel Sharon's service to Israel, both in the military and political office, spanned 50 years, 5 decades seldom free of controversy. Speaking earlier to Youssef Munayyer, executive director of the Palestinian Center in Washington, D.C., he told me Ariel Sharon was responsible for some of the bloodiest marks on Palestinian history.
Well, there were several of them, and they're really scattered throughout the history of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, going back to the earliest years of this interaction, including the events in 1953 in Kibya, a Palestinian village, in which Ariel Sharon's unit under his command carried out an attack on a Palestinian village that involved the destruction of homes while civilians were still inside, resulting in the death of 69 civilians, mostly women and children. And it only got worse from that point forward. I mean, this was a person who, even among the Israeli military establishment, was singled out for his viciousness on the field of battle. He also carried out the destruction of thousands of homes in Palestinian refugee camps in Gaza in 1970. And of course, perhaps the bloodiest of these events was the massacre at Sabra and Shatila. Throughout Ariel Sharon's history, which is parallel to Israel's history, wherever he went, there was wanton destruction and often a great bloodshed. And more often than not, civilian bloodshed.
At the funeral, among the many former leaders and current heads of state, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden described Mr. Sharon as an indomitable bulldozer. The security of his people was his unwavering mission. What does that say about the Obama administration's relationship with Israel?
Well, look, I think it's very clear that the United States, of course, they have a very close relationship with Israel. But as a party that is attempting to act as the ostensible mediator between Israelis and Palestinians, it became very clear, not with the Obama administration, but during the Bush administration, that they lost their moral compass. When President Bush, now some 13 years ago almost, called Ariel Sharon, who is clearly among the most vicious and violent of Israeli leaders, a man of peace. The words that we're seeing from Biden today and from other American leaders, including John Kerry and President Obama, marking the passing of this man in any positive light, is really not the first departure from reality when it comes to the U.S.'s characterization of him. And I think, of course, it speaks to the U.S.'s failure to really recognize what is destructive to peace and a peace process versus what is conducive to it. And you know, what the United States has been able to achieve in terms of peace between Israelis and Palestinians, which of course is nothing, is in large part because of that.
shortly before suffering a stroke, Sharon removed Israeli settlers from the Gaza Strip. He declared that move as an attempt to ease tensions with the Palestinians. But was that how Palestinians themselves viewed it?
Looking back at that one moment, you have to also contextualize it in everything else that was going on. Sharon is being remembered at this moment for that particular move, but many people forget that as he removed 5,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip, under his premiership, he had presided over an increase of 75,000 settlers in the West Bank. So the notion that this man is somehow, you know, a proponent of peace and willing to, you know, withdraw from Palestinian territory for the objective of peace is really not true. The decision to leave Gaza was a tactical one. There was, you know, about 5,000 Israeli settlers among 1.5 million Palestinians. The costs of protecting those Israelis became, you know, irrationally high. And the value of that small piece of territory for the Israelis did not outweigh the value of the perception that was created because of that withdrawal that led many to characterize them, even to today, as proponents of peace, when in reality they were taking those settlers, putting them in the West Bank, and putting many more settlers in the West Bank as well. So I think when you look at Sharon's biography in totality, you can only come away really with one conclusion, and that this man was an enemy of peace and not a proponent of it.
Youssef Munayyer, Executive Director of the Palestinian Center in Washington, D.C. Now, lawyers for the Senate and President faced off today at the U.S. Supreme Court over whether a number of executive appointments made in 2012 violated the Constitution. The case focuses on the National Labor Relations Board, the body tasked with protecting workers' rights across the country, and a ruling against them could overturn hundreds of labor rulings and forever change the balance of power in the U.S. government. Our correspondent Alice Olstein was at the High Court this morning and brings us this report.
Supreme Court waded deep into the constitutional weeds this morning in a long argument about when the president can appoint officials that Congress can't or won't confirm. Amid long back-and-forth arguments about the meaning of the words the and happen, the lawyer for the Obama administration warned a ruling against them would make important government work grind to a halt, while lawyers for a soft drink company and a group of Republican senators said a ruling against them would give the White House too much power to put unpopular people in office.
The Senate has the power to decide when it is in session and when it is not in session.
That's Utah Republican Mike Lee, one of 45 senators represented in the case. His team argued that President Obama's recess appointments are unconstitutional because they were made when the Senate wasn't really in recess. In early 2012, the Senate did take several weeks of vacation and formally announced that no business would be conducted, but they held what are called pro forma sessions, where a single senator gavels in and gavels out just seconds later. Several justices questioned today whether this counts as being in session or whether it's just a ploy to prevent the president from making appointments, but attorney Noel Francisco told reporters outside the court that it should count as a real session.
That's how the Senate passes the majority of legislation that comes before it and confirms the majority of nominees that come before it. If you flip on the TV on any given day when all would agree that the Senate is in session, you're not going to see 51 senators on the floor. You're generally going to see one or two accompanied by the entire Senate staff. They're in a position to do business by unanimous consent if they want to, and that's how the Senate generally does business.
But all members of the Senate do have to be physically present for votes. Being in their office across from the Capitol is a bit different than being a long plane ride home away in their home state. Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Elena Kagan added during today's arguments that it's also a completely different world than the senators lived in when the Constitution was written, and they questioned whether the whole concept of recess appointments is an outdated rule from the horse and buggy era. Justice Kagan said most modern presidents use the recess appointments loophole, quote, not to deal with congressional absence, but congressional intransigence. Attorney Noel Francisco agreed and called this an abuse of executive power.
What he has the power to do is to convene an emergency session and force the Senate to consider his nominees. And he can publicly shame them for being derelict in their duties. But what the president can never do is force the Senate to act against its will, nor can he do an end run around their refusal to act by installing an appointment over their objection, because that's at war with the advice and consent process, which is how nominees are supposed to be confirmed.
But President Obama's lawyer, Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, warned that hundreds of labor board rulings impacting workers and unions, along with many other agency and court decisions made by recess appointments, would be under a cloud if the court ruled against them. Alicia Bannon with the Brennan Center for Justice, which filed an amicus brief on this case, said it's also crucial to preserve the recess appointment power going forward.
It's allowed the president to ensure that our government can still work even when the Senate is unable to confirm nominees. If you dramatically transform that power and narrow it, you're giving an awful lot more power to the Senate to really scuttle the nominations process altogether, and you know, with it, leave our agencies and courts not able to function.
But the court may not have to choose sides between the Senate and the White House. They could simply throw out the case, arguing that it's a political question of Republican senators versus a Democratic president, and not a constitutional dispute worthy of their consideration. A decision is expected this summer. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. Jewish social services organizations are warning of a growing need for financial assistance to help America's Holocaust survivor population. It's estimated up to a quarter of all survivors living in the US are at or below the federally mandated poverty level. And as Steve Mort reports from Florida, some are having to make painful choices.
Nearly 70 years after the Holocaust, many survivors of Nazi persecution are facing dire financial hardship. There are some 120,000 Holocaust survivors in the United States, many of whom have to rely on social services agencies for help in paying for basics like food and medication. The largest survivor populations are located in New York and here in South Florida.
Cooking and preparing food. Do you need help with that?
Sally Cimino meets with a caseworker from the Jewish Family Service in Broward County, Florida. She's one of thousands of Holocaust survivors that social services agencies say have outlived their savings. Cimino can no longer afford one of her medications.
It's been now months that I don't take it. One medication that I take monthly, it's $179. And I can afford to take that. And my blood pressure goes up and I take some pills. I try to cover it with something else, but it's not as good as that medication that I needed badly.
Kenneth Moskowitz runs the Jewish Family Service of Broward County. He says hundreds of survivors have few family members in the U.S. and lean on his organization for financial support.
Many of the survivors don't have family, maybe never had children, or for one reason or another, they don't have a relationship anymore with their family, their children. So for us, you know, we are that family.
Did you paint that?
Yes.
91-year-old Felice Taub receives help from a carer provided by the Ruth and Norman Rails Jewish Family Service in Boca Raton, Florida. Born in Poland, Taub is still haunted by her war experiences.
We were sent to Siberia from the Russians. We thought we were going to run away from the Germans to the Russian side, but then the Russians didn't trust us. And they send us to Siberia.
Danielle Hartman, president and CEO of the Ruth and Norman Rails Jewish Family Service, says it's not just financial difficulties facing survivors. Many feel unable to live in care facilities because of the traumatic associations they have with institutionalized settings.
It could be a shower. It could be asking someone to wear an identification badge. It could be asking people to wait in line. There could be issues regarding food and hoarding. So we find that it's better for the health and wellness of the survivor population to remain living at home.
Hartman says her organization spends $5,000 a month more on home care than it did just 3 years ago, looking after the growing needs of 300 Holocaust survivors. Much of the financial support going to survivors is distributed by groups like the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany. The U.S. government's proposed $15 million in assistance to the community, with an estimated 25% of survivors living below the poverty level. Steve Mort, Miami.
Now to French affairs, literally, and the alleged liaison between the President, François Hollande, and an actress. The French First Lady has been in hospital since Friday, when a magazine printed an article about the alleged affair. She and the President are not married, but have been together since 2007. FSN's Kate Fisher has been speaking to Dominique Moissy, senior advisor at the French Institute for International Relations in Paris, and she began by asking how the French public has reacted.
I think the French pretend to be uninterested. One could say that they are blasé, that it's normal nearly for presidents to have affairs. But I think there is some embarrassment. It doesn't look glorious or glamorous. And I think by the end of the day, there's a large element of hypocrisy. In fact, the French are interested. They want to know more. But they pretend this is below them to concentrate so much time on such a puny affair.
There are bigger problems in France and the world that perhaps the president should be focusing on.
Yes, there is a sense that the president should be concentrating all his energies to fight the issue of unemployment. And the French are asking themselves questions. Is the president as undecided on public matters than he is on private matters? Is he hesitating between two women the way he was hesitating between two policies yesterday?
Do you think that perhaps it makes France look, certainly France appears less statesmanlike on the world stage somehow?
Well, yes, but there's a sense of continuity between Hollande and Nicolas Sarkozy, mixing of private and public life. So there is a sense that, well, the Germans are working. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, is only thinking about politics, about economy, while French presidents are torn between their public responsibilities and their private dilemmas.
And what of François Hollande's official partner? She's in hospital. What do you know of her condition?
Well, she is still hospitalized and will remain so for a few more days. And of course, it's a bad sign when the French are getting every day new revelation about the psychological status of the First Lady, a First Lady that for the first time in the history of the Fifth Republic is not the legally married wife of the French president. So there is an interrogation about her status. If the First Lady is not any longer first in the heart of the French president, why is she occupying a wing of the Élysée Palace? The French want clarification from their president.
Dominique Moissy speaking with FSN's Kate Fisher. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme. Email us at reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Tuesday, will the latest scandal to hit Governor Chris Christie scupper any run at the White House? That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin's desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.